Welcome to Hedge Fund Tips with Tom Hayes. I'm Tom Hayes, and this is your 188th video cast, 178th podcast for the week ending May 25th, 2023. Wishing you an early happy Memorial Day. Want to thank you for everyone who served the country. We're very grateful, and that gives us the freedom to do the things we do and have the greatest country in the world. So thank you very much. We'll quickly get to the media. We've got a lot of good stuff and a lot of Ask Me Anything questions this week. So first off, I want to thank Phil Yin and Ryan Gallagher for having me on CGTN America last night to discuss the debt ceiling, among many other things. You definitely want to check it out. Phil's really phenomenal with his questions. It's always a fun back and forth. So we don't have time to go through it on this, but just click on play and you can go ahead and watch that yourself. Our quote of the day is, individuals who cannot master their emotions are ill-suited to profit from the investment process. That's by Ben Graham, Warren Buffett's favorite teacher. And I think now more than ever that holds. Those of you who have been with us for a while, you remember last summer I had the privilege to interview Philip Vassilio, the CIO and partner of Legatum Group. And the story behind Legatum is pretty amazing. It's two brothers, Chris Chandler and Richard Chandler. They started out together. They had a family business that was passed down to them. It was basically like the Harrods of New Zealand. And they decided they didn't want to be in that business. They sold it for $10 million. And they went on to turn that $10 million into $5 billion in just two decades. And really doing deep value stuff and stuff that, you know, went way against them before it went for them. And there was one story, you know, with everything going on with Alibaba, there was one story that I remembered from this one article that's really out there about the institutional investor. From when, because they cover, you know, they did the Japanese banks, they did Brazilian equities, and it goes through how did they turn the $10 million into $5 billion. And we covered a lot of that in past podcasts. But the one story that stood out was they got stuck in Russia. So they made a ton of money on some of these things in the mid-90s in Russia. And they began to buy up the Chandler's timing on the sale of the two largest investments in Russia proved a much greater coup. Concerned that the country's burgeoning market for treasury bills, which were known as GKOs and carried interest rates as much as 100%, was little more than a pyramid scheme. They sold their 4% stake in UAS and their 11% stake in Mocenegro over the summer of 1997. At the height of the Russian stock market boom, the amounts they received, 700 and 300 million respectively, produced a profit of 416%. As jitters over the GKO market increased, Russian shares lost 50% of their value between August 1997 and February 1998. Believing that the country had had sufficient fright to pull back from the brink of default, the Chandlers plunged in again into the Russian market in February, investing nearly $1 billion for slightly less than 5% of Gazprom. Among private investors, only Germany's Ruhrgas, which had a little more than 5%, held a larger stake. Sovereign's optimism proved premature. Sovereign is the name of when they were together. They went off and did their own separate things after some time, but Sovereign was when Richard and Chris were together before Chris broke off and started Legatum, which is the investments are managed by Philip Vassilio, and have had the pleasure to meet him many times, as well as some of his partners, and it's just a world-class organization for sure. But anyway, Sovereign optimism proved to be premature. Gazprom's market capitalization, which had plummeted from about $20 billion to $20 billion from $47 billion at the end of 1997, collapsed to a low of $4 billion after Russia defaulted on its debt and devalued the ruble in August of 1998. That meltdown left the brothers sitting on an estimated loss of close to $800 million on the billion-dollar investment. I could have said to myself, I'm a bad investor. I got it wrong, says Richard. Instead, I said, we got in a bit early, but the value is still there. Just because the market deserted Russia, it did not mean that Gazprom was a bad company. It was a great company supplying 25% of Europe's gas. Indeed, Gazprom held natural gas reserves worth a stunning $2.9 trillion. It was not a profitable company. However, Gazprom posted losses of $7 billion in 1998, $2.8 billion in 1999, while amassing debts of $9 billion. The reason the Chandler suspected, once again, was transfer pricing. The utility was selling vast quantities of gas at below market prices to a little-known company called Iterra Group that Sovereign and others believed had close ties to Gazprom chief executive Rem Vyacherev and other company directors who held five seats on the 11-person board. The government, which then held a 38% stake, had five seats of Rugas, which voted with management one. Gazprom also transferred control of many of its management allies' interest-free loans that an independent audit committee of the Duma, Russia's legislature, estimated in 2000 totaled $850 million. It was a company that was rife with investor abuse, says UFG's Ryan. To combat these abuses and release the company's value, the Chandlers backed a campaign by Ryan's partner, UFG chairman Boris Fyodorov, to gain a seat on Gazprom's board and oust Vyacherev, a former finance minister and one of Russia's most prominent reformers. Fyodorov asserted the company was plundering corporate assets for the benefit of third parties. Their stance wasn't without risk. Fyodorov's Siberian Husky was killed by a rare form of cyanide, and Ryan was repeatedly questioned by tax authorities, according to the people close to the two financiers. You think China's tough? I mean, look, you know, try investing in a company that's mafia-run and taking them on with a proxy contest. I mean, that takes some cojones, that's for sure. These sources say both men believe they were targets of Gazprom-inspired campaign of terror. Neither Fyodorov nor Ryan would comment on the alleged intimidation. To calm his nerves, Richard, that's Richard Chandler, took up golf in 1998 and began to make an annual two-month trip to Florence to learn Italian. So apparently he's a 12 handicap. And I can say, you know, the long and the short of it is they got out of it with a profit. He knew the intrinsic value was there. That was a lot hairier than anything we're dealing with China. But these are the kind of hairy situations and short-term volatility that you have to deal with to generate those type of returns. You're not going to turn $10 million into $5 billion in 2 decades by buying breakouts or buying things that are already up 10x. You got to buy things that are totally hated, down a lot. They go down even more after you buy it while you're waiting for it to come. Then they start to go up. Then people get interested. Then they start to go up a lot. Then everyone gets interested. Then they go up a ton. You get massive multiple expansion. People are just panic buying into it, and that's when you start to lay off. And if you read this article by Institutional Investor and go through every situation they were in, 90% of them, they went dramatically against them before they went for them, provided that they had the intrinsic value. And that's what we've been trying to communicate with Baba, and we're going to get into it in more detail today. But it's called Secrets of Sovereign. It's at institutionalinvestor.com, and it's March 16, 2006. So sometimes, you know, and my handicap is dropping like a rock. Sometimes when these things, when you know you have the value and it's moving against you, sometimes you just really need to sit on your hands, you know, is what Charlie Munger always says. And I can see why, you know, it's interesting. Many of the greatest trades in the history of the business have had those situations. If you read John Paulson's The Greatest Trade when he was shorting subprime, it went 2.5 years against him. And that's no joke, because it's not like you just buy the stock and wait. When you buy CDS, you have to keep paying out premiums. Money keeps going out and out and out until you're finally right. And that's when he made the huge multi-bagger once everything rolled over. But I remember in reading his book, he would go on like 5 and 10 mile runs. Like there was nothing to do. He knew he had the trade right, but it just kept going against him. And in his case, dangerously against him, because one, he didn't have permanent capital. If you remember from Michael Burry, what was happening with his fund. But two, it wasn't just that he was losing on the mark to market, he was losing because he had to keep paying the insurance premiums until the thing finally paid out. And even then, the banks didn't want to pay him. So it was a whole headache. But ultimately, it became the greatest trade ever. He made like $15 billion. He gave $10 back to the casino. And I think he's just gotten out of the business with $5 billion. He said, enough is enough. So he had enough free drinks and realized, let me walk out of here with some of my wallet intact. But the point is that we know the intrinsic value is here. We don't have to deal with mafia. We do have to deal with some communists, but we don't have to deal with mafia. to extract the value. And I think there's a lot less hair with than some of the situations they went through. But read their story. It's a good recap if you don't remember from last July. And it just made me think of, what do you do in situations like this? And the answer was, from Richard, it was go play golf. So next, want to just kind of zoom out on some of the companies we've touched on in recent weeks and so on, and beyond, and kind of like just a big picture view, because we've gone through the fundamentals so many times, but sometimes you just need to like zoom back from the day to day when a stock is up 2% or down 3% or whatever. You know, take a look at Amazon. This is a holding here, and you can see it's been very rare times when you've seen these indicators. And the reason we're talking about indicators is not we really care about technical analysis, but just to show that this kind of happens over and over again, these extremes where things get sold off. So Amazon sold from 188 down to 81 recently last year. Now it's back up to 114. If you remember, that was a huge table pounder in the fall for us. But, you know, you look at these situations. This was the tech wreck, happened once. Then it happened again in the great financial crisis. Again, you got these indicators down to these extreme levels. And then it happened one more time just this past year. And if you don't buy at levels like that, then, you know, you're probably in the wrong business when you're dealing with a business that high quality. Same thing, obviously, with BABA. We've covered many times, and we're going to go into some more detail. But this situation is very, very common. You know, the last only, we don't have a large enough sample, but you know, you saw here a crash of about 50%. It rallies and then it checks back to test it. You know, here's a little check back, here's a little check back, and then you get your parabolic move. Same thing in 2016. You had this low and then a rally, like we had up to 120, actually very similar. And then this massive checkback, which looks like it's going back to the lows. You see this massive checkback, massive checkback, massive checkback here. And then boom, you get your parabolic move. So I think this is just the final nail in the coffin for the weak hands to roast them out. And then we can start to move higher. And we're going to talk about, well, what, you know, that's wishful thinking. What are the catalysts? We're going to get into catalysts. Don't worry about that. Here's Bank of America. Similar type of situation, you know, the great financial crisis, you had this monster rally like we had off the pandemic lows, then you roll back over kind of halfway the move, and then you start to move again. This one, it's kind of best in the business. You had a similar situation in 2001. So, you know, these things happen over and over. The key is it a quality business? Is it durable? Is it lasting? Then it's going to eventually work its way to new highs, even if it goes lower. Here's Baxter, the medical devices, which we covered on Charles Payne. And we talked about the tax-free spin, if you remember. This, it looks exactly like the tech wreck. You know, you have this first thing, everyone thinks it's the bottom. Then you just puke everyone out, and then it's straight back up, and it just works up. Same thing here. You had this crash, a fake rally, pukes everyone out, and now it's back on the way up. And again, you just look at these extremes. These aren't reasons to buy. Our reasons to buy are fundamentally based, and we've gone through those in past calls. But when you zoom out, you don't worry about the day-to-day nonsense. Here's Cooper Standard, was $146 stock when they were doing 95 million cars. Looks like we're going to get back to 90 in the next couple of years. And now with Ford, we'll talk about that. They want to do even more numbers. They're scrapping their pandemic plan of scarce production and high prices. They're now going in to fill the lots and offer incentives. And that's going to take the volumes up, which is going to take this stock right back up to big numbers, which we covered last week. Here's Disney down, you know, over 55% when we initiated. And you have these situations like in 2009, it dropped 50% and then, you know, shakes everyone out. Same thing in 2002 and 2003. Goes sideways for a half a year, goes sideways for a half a year, and then works its way to the new high. Why? Because there's no other Disneyland. There's no other content library that's even close. So if it goes a little lower before it works its way to new highs over the next few years, then it has to happen. But Generac, this is a play on new houses. There, you know, nothing has changed about millennials needing new homes, with the bulk of them at, you know, 33 years old. That's still there. rates will, you know, we'll get through this. Rates will start to come down during the back half of the year. You get the mortgage rate back in the fives. New homes are going to boom, and Generac is going to absolutely score on that basis. Then Google was another table pounder. Again, it got down to this level that you haven't seen since the tech wreck. It was down almost 50% because ChatGPT was going to change the world. And then guess what? Like we said, they've got more AI than ChatGPT. They forgot more AI than ChatGPT will ever know. The difference was they were trying to wait for the government to regulate, so that, they didn't do anything wrong. And then ChatGPT, jumped out in front of them. They're like, all right, you're a joke. We've got more stuff than you. And they're just going to, trust me, it's not the first mover in this type of situation. These guys will be just fine, and the stock is reflecting it. But guess what? It's had this monster move in the last few weeks, which you can hardly even tell on the long-term chart when you zoom out. But now everyone's saying it's overbought, tech's going to roll back over, blah, blah, blah. And sure, so what are we at? $123 up from $80, so that's a 50% move. Could you move back down to $100 before going up back up to new highs at $150? Yeah, you could. But in the scheme of things, it's nothing. And that's what I'm trying to communicate. Intel. Okay. So today, Nvidia's up. Intel's down. Oh, it's a disaster. Nothing has changed between last night and tonight. It's got 70 something percent of the PC business. Inventory peaked in Q1. Over the next few quarters, people are going to buy PCs again. They bought them all 3 years ago. They're now going to be buying new ones and restocking. And guess what? You saw the same exact situation in 2009. You go sideways for a half a year. Sideways for half a year after a more than 50% drop off, and then you're off to the races. So even during the tech wreck, you had the same situation sideways, and then you work back higher. 3M, which we covered on Charles Payne, it's like, oh, it's going down. No, it's basically doing nothing for the last 6 months, as it does toward every bottom. You have this, even during the great financial crisis, which is nothing like this. You have this fake bottom right here, and then you get a final flush, you know, this double type thing here, and then you work back up to new highs. And I'm not saying that because the chart says it, that's what's going to happen. We've already done the fundamentals. We've already covered that. When you get into irrational pricing due to a silly debt ceiling or some stupid, ridiculous thing, you just kind of have to zoom out, look at the stuff, go play golf and wait, if you know the quality of the business. PayPal, so the thing here is Apple Pay is going to overtake everything. Apple Pay is going to have a serious impact, but not on all their business. And we saw in the earnings that they're actually growing faster than ever. The part that's growing the fastest is slightly lower margins, so analysts freaked out that the overall margins are going down. But if the overall profits and cash flow are going up, who gives a you know what? So, you know, that one will take some time, but that business is fine. They're compounding capital in the high teens. They just need a new CEO as a catalyst for the next step. And there's an activist in there that will help get that done. Rolls-Royce, now you're seeing the servicing hours. It's up over 100% off the lows. Stock will work higher over the next few years. Here's just an extreme version of the semiconductors when we were pounding the table in October and November when no one wanted it. You know, these things happen over and over, you know, 2011, 2012, similar conditions, and then, you know, monster multi-year run. Then you've got 2016, same type of situation, then a monster run. So it just happens here. Stanley Black & Decker, tools, etc. Again, same type of situation. You see these extremes, they work sideways, it feels like it's never ending, and then boom, when they go, it comes all at once. Same thing in 2002, 2003, when they go all at once. And, you know, it's just dealing, most people can't live with this, because it looks like nothing here, but this is 6 months of daily moves of 5 and 10%, and it just drives people out of their mind. They can't stand it. So, small caps, same type of story. Absolute extreme like in 2016, and then it worked its way higher, same as 2011, 2012, that, you know, it started to move up, then you have this fake out, check back, and then straight up, and it leaves everyone scratching their heads. And, you know, in that case, so you just see tech, no one wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. I mean, this was extreme, and it's barely even getting started. So VF Corp, they beat earnings, top line, bottom line, China's coming back, no one wants to touch with a 10-foot pole because of debt, etc. But it does this every recession. Look what it did in 2000, 66% drop in 2008 and 2009, grind sideways, and then works to new highs. Same thing during 2000-2001 recession, grind sideways, you know, fake bottom, shakeout, fake bottom, shakeout, and then works its way higher. VNO, back to 2009, great financial crisis lows when the banks were going to be nationalized. Same story here. A class will be fine. B and C will be toast. Does it go to 5 before it goes to 45? Maybe. I doubt it. But that's where it is. And if you look at the revenues, if you look at the buildings, if you look at all the things we've talked about over the last few weeks since we bought it during that bank crisis down here, wherever it was, same story. And then biotech, same thing, 2016. You get this kind of drop. And these patterns just repeat over and over. Then you get the first move up, and then you get a check back, first move up, check back, and then you get the final parabolic move towards new highs, and I think this time will be no different. So yeah, that's just zooming out, and these are the type of things that these guys figured out while they were playing golf and turned $10 million into $5 billion. So they were willing to deal with the hair. If you go through position by position, most of their positions went 20 to 80% against them before they became multi-baggers. And that's why they're probably among the best in the world that's ever lived. So what else do you want to talk about? Next, this is from Ryan Dietrich. Where is this? Hold on for a second. Basically saying when the stock market's up 7% 100 days in on average, it finishes out the year 23%. So another 9% on average. Average for the year is 23.6%. So all of that looks very promising moving forward. So if the average is 23 for the year and we're at 7.2, that could be another 10 to 15%. I think that's the pain trade. I think based on 5.3 trillion in money markets, most overweight bonds versus stocks since great financial crisis lows, I think that's the pain that's got to be delivered. What could be the catalyst? Maybe these clowns in Washington will figure something out over the weekend. You get the surprise of that. Then you get a pause with the Fed. You get the dollar weakening, and we're off to the races. So that's that. On to some of the news. This is from the New York Times. China's tech giants signal. Wanted to do this. This is from Brendan Ahern. He runs the $5 billion or somewhat, maybe bigger. I haven't looked at the AUM, but it's the biggest China internet ETF, KWEB. And Brendan put this out, you know, everyone's talking about this one academic at a academic conference that said predicted this COVID surge in the next few weeks in China. The data just doesn't bear that out, because if you look at the January COVID surge, here was the metro passenger traffic by region. It really fell off a cliff. So it was already happening in December. People were worried about the surge. But here, there's been absolutely zero change in subway traffic. Now, could that change in coming weeks? Of course it could change in coming weeks. But right now, the rumors of China's demise are greatly exaggerated. And even if it happens, it's the Chinese government. You know, look, the people don't want to be locked down. They started rioting. The government blinked. They said, fine, you want COVID? Have at it. They stopped recording cases. They stopped doing lockdowns. They said, just everyone go get COVID. Have a great day. And that's exactly what happened in January. They all did that. Now the immunity's run out. After 6 months later, maybe you'll get another wave, maybe you won't. But it doesn't matter. They're not counting cases. They're not locking down the city. So no one cares. People go about their business like they did in every other state except for the coasts in the United States. If you went down to Florida in the middle of 2000, 2001, 2002, nothing happened. In Texas, nothing ever happened. Life goes on. And in China, I think after 3 years, they'll wear their masks. They'll go, you know, they'll get it or not get it. They've got the vaccines for the XBB variant if they want it. Here's the traffic. That's all that matters. And even if this collapses, it's another month. You know, after a year of waiting, who gives it, you know, another month is not the end of the world. It's just 8 more rounds of golf. So, Ryan, okay, we covered Ryan. Here is Alibaba. I thought this was interesting. You know, they're talking about earnings. China tech giants signaled the first steps in a bumpy recovery and how most of the earnings came in better than expected. I like the last sentence from this guy in, he's head of investment strategies at asset management company KGI Asia in Hong Kong. He says, quote, "I would suggest to forget the past. Now they are coming back and we're seeing gradual improvement. We need to give them a new evaluation standard, i.e. multiple expansion coming to a theater near you." Biden says U.S.-China relations set to improve, quote, "very shortly." This was after the G7 meeting. And then, sure enough, Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo is meeting with her Chinese counterpart this week. So, look. And he, by the way, he called the balloon a silly balloon, which I don't think it was a silly balloon. I think that was a serious balloon. But leaving that aside, it's silly in the context of destroying business relations because it hurts us as much as it hurts China in terms of the things that we need to, you know, if we don't want $4,000 iPhones, it makes sense to continue to have a relationship. And for everyone that thinks that all of the production is going to move to India, I lived in India for 6 months. I can assure you, you don't want to trust your entire supply chain in India. There are a lot of extraordinary things about India, but that's not one of them. And it's going to take some time for them to get up to the infrastructure. And they're probably a decade to a decade and a half behind China in terms of development and infrastructure and the different things. In some areas, they kind of skipped over in intellectual capital and services. They're actually doing quite well. But in terms of manufacturing your stuff and replacing China, even in Vietnam, you know, I talked to some people that are high up at Newell and everything. They're like, there's no other China. Like, you can leave at the margins, but it's not happening. It's absolutely not happening. And what you're seeing, even from guys like Jensen Huang, came out yesterday saying there is no other China. There's only one China. A CEO of NVIDIA warns enormous damage if China chip war escalates. So what you're going to see is the whole tech sector start to put pressure on the administration and just say, listen, rhetoric is one thing, but this is hurting our bottom line. Like, let's get with the program here. This hurts American jobs too, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and these are now the biggest weights in the S&P 500. So some of these companies, so, you know, if Apple is hurt, if NVIDIA is hurt, if these tech companies are hurt by stupid trade wars from uninformed politicians on both sides, then everyone loses. And sooner or later, the powers that be in the companies will get the message across clearly. China equity rout deepens as traders rush to sell before the holidays. So that's what was happening in China overnight, kind of the last flush here in our view. All right, now on to the U.S. markets. Retail investors are finally capitulating. You're starting to see institutional money come in. So retail investors capitulate just as stocks break out to new 2023 highs, certainly on the NASDAQ. Then you've got share buybacks continue at a torrid pace while investors sit on the sidelines. So while retail investors are in $5.3 trillion of money markets, companies are buying their stock back hand over fist. And that's what's going to take people by surprise as we break higher over time, is they're going to have to chase up at new highs. Fed officials were divided over June rate pause. This is from the Fed whisper Nick Timiraos. The implication here is there are more and more people that are, you know, in between either a pause or a skip for the June meeting. If that happens, that'll be very good for the dollar downtrend. We think that happens, even though percentages have been edging up, that they'll hike again. I don't think it's going to happen because Powell has been really worried about banking strains. The banking crisis is not over so long as rates keep going up, because it's going to keep hurting their portfolios and causing them to have to raise capital and causing equity flight the Deadpool list is still active. Nothing has changed in that regard. But if interest rates were to settle and people could get confidence in the loans and the balance sheet, then I think we're probably okay. But it's them going straight up that caused the problem. And the only way to fix it, if they want to keep going straight up, is to backstop all the deposits. They don't seem to be doing that. So then the only way to fix it is stop making rates go higher and just, you know, balance your inflation fantasy target of 2% with systemic risk of a banking collapse, and choose the least of the two painful choices, which is run inflation above trend. We have no choice at debt to GDP above 120%. Inflate some of that away, run inflation at 3-5% for a few years and call it a day. Auto dealers finally have cars to sell again. This is good because following fuller lots means more incentives. More incentives means more demand and more buyers. More buyers means more production, and more production means more earnings power for Cooper Standard. And that's the whole game. Thought this was interesting, also from Brendan Ahern. Ralph Lauren, interesting revenue divergence between Asia and China versus Europe and the U.S. by geography. Fourth quarter sales was led by Asia. Fourth quarter sales meaning they're on a different fiscal year, so the most recent quarter, up 13% on a reported basis and 29% in constant currency on a 13-week comparable basis, with China up more than 30% in reported dollars and over 40% constant currency, 13-week comparable sales. So this is a big deal. You know, China is the driver of growth. Same thing with VF Corp, with the North Face. VF Corp reported better than expected fourth quarter results on Tuesday, driven by strength in the North Face and ongoing recovery in China as consumers return following a period of COVID lockdowns. So we'll see more of that in fits and starts. Now on to the article of the week, the long run stock market and sentiment results. So when I was thinking about this writing this week, the song The Long Run immediately came to mind. The Eagles released it in 1979. According to Henley, the title track was in part a response to press articles that said they were, quote, passé as disco was then dominant and punk was emerging, which inspired such lines as, quote, who is going to make it? We'll find out in the long run. You know, some of these lines are key. People talking about us, they got nothing else to do. When it all comes down, we'll still come through in the long run. Ooh, I want to tell you it's a long run. And I think that's also the theme song for the guys over at Sovereign that turned $10 million into $5 billion and the volatility that they faced in every single investment they were in. And that's why they got the returns. You can't have those type of returns without commensurate volatility. And that's just the game. So, and I like the last line, who is going to make it? We'll find out in the long run. The similarities to being an investor in Alibaba are striking. The Eagles turned out to be right. Disco and punk, not so much. So, Alibaba, we're nearing the end to the final shakeout cycle. We've been discussing Alibaba the last few weeks. We've discussed a possible final overthrow into the high 70s in recent podcast video casts, along the lines of what was seen in March. So you can see there it panicked down to $74 last March. And we're now in that neighborhood. So I think we got below 80 today. I don't know, 78, something like that. So we're probably down here. Nice little overthrow to take out the last few hands. But this is just tracking like unbelievably, eerily similar to this Justin Mammoth sentiment cycle that was written like 30 years ago. You had returning confidence, you had enthusiasm, you had the crash, you got down to panic here, complete flush, then you get the bounce, then you get the final discouragement low down here, then you get the monster rally back up to the resistance, which is anxiety, when we went from 60 to 120 in a few months when the dollar weakened, then you get flushed out to aversion, which is where we are now. It's interesting here, they show a lower low on aversion, so it bottoms, then it spikes up, and then you get a lower low flush, very similar situation to what we're seeing now. Then you get a run right back up to resistance, and then we'll get a check back. It probably hit a 120, go to 110, and then straight back up to returning confidence and towards new highs. Look, again, we don't really, this is all nonsense, basically. I mean, the fundamentals are still there, but it's just a guidepost to keep our minds straight towards the underlying value, like you heard from Richard Chandler and Chris and what they accomplished in their individual investments when things were going nutty in terms of price in the public security markets relative to value. You know, I was thinking about one thing today. Imagine if you bought in with a group to take Alibaba private today at $200 billion. They did about $25 billion of free cash flow. They got 87 billion back out the debt. Let's just round numbers, call it 70 or 65 billion dollars of cash, net cash. So you back that out. So you're basically buying the business for 130 million. The business is going to generate about $30 billion of cash per year for the next 4 years. It's the equivalent of buying one of the highest quality businesses in the world, assuming zero growth and getting a 4-year payback period on 100% of your investment. Now, if I offered that to any of you sophisticated people listening to this call that have money to do any type of private deal like that, you would be saying, can I take down the whole entire book? And when it comes to public markets, because of the squiggly lines and the noisy headlines, we forget what we're paying and what we're getting. 4-year payback period. You know, I once thought about actually taking over a public shell and go out and, you know, the only type of businesses you can buy for 4 and 5 times EBITDA, let's say, are crappy little businesses with no scale, like, you know, mom and pop delis down the street. You could buy it 4 times cash flow. You could buy a car repair shop. You could buy a car wash at 4 times cash flow. You know, and I was thinking one time, maybe I'd just buy, like, get control of a public shell, which we've done before in the first fund I work for. But instead of buying one business, buy like 100 of these little tiny businesses at 4 times EBITDA, roll them into a public company, get the multiple arbitrage, and, you know, buy them for 4 and they'll trade in the public markets. And then you have the growth and you have the cash flow and you can buy in the shares. You know, maybe we'll do that. But never would you imagine you could get this quality of a business at this type of multiple. And that's what's happening. So this is what's happening. Here's the PE at 9 times, whatever. I mean, I don't really care about PEs, but this week there were headlines about a COVID resurgence in China. Since the government no longer tracks or publishes case numbers or institutes lockdowns, it'll probably work out to be the equivalent of a short-term bad flu season in the rest of the world, if the quote-unquote academic who predicted it at a random conference is even correct. Dialogue is resuming between U.S. and China. While there are never any guarantees when it comes to big egos involved in politics, the mutual interdependence dictates there should be incremental progress. That's the key. While the daily headlines on China beat up shareholders on a daily basis in every effort to separate them from their stock before we return to confidence, confidence meaning returning confidence, we prefer to deal with the facts. Okay, Alibaba shareholders today, we covered that last week, this poor MMA fighter, bare-knuckle MMA fighter, that's what an Alibaba shareholder looks like today. This is what we think an Alibaba shareholder will look like 12 to 24 months from now, where you have Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy doing their cheers from the St. Croix Beach in Trading Places after they made all their money in orange juice futures. So here are the key facts from Thursday evening's earnings call. The most important line in the entire call edified exactly what we said 2 weeks ago when we presented our sum of the parts analysis on Alibaba, where we broke down piece by piece of the 6 parts, assuming steady state growth, not even assuming normalized growth with the exception of the cloud. So we basically said the rest of the businesses will stay as they are, COVID level growth rates, which is ridiculous. They're gonna bounce back even harder. But you know, the cloud is the real future opportunity. But long story short, we got to $300 a share conservatively, and it could be more if you get the resume back to the trend line growth. When we assigned our valuations on each part of the business, we allotted $200 billion for AliCloud over the next couple of years. Keep in mind, the entire 6 parts of the business are trading today at about $200 billion. We assigned that to 1 part of the 6, and Taobao is worth double that. As the industry triples and they retain their number one position, 36% share. Here's what Zhang said on the call. CEO Daniel Zhang, quote, "We would be happy to see and indeed expect to see Alibaba Cloud as an independent company growing to be as big as and perhaps even bigger than the Alibaba Group is today." Okay, now, here's what we know from being in the markets for many, many years. The CEOs always go with the subsidiary that they think is going to grow the fastest when they break the company up to unlock value to shareholders. Zhang, who currently runs Alibaba Group, okay, and has an opportunity to go with Taobao, which is today many multiples, doing 35 times as much revenue as the cloud, is choosing to go to run the cloud, not going to run Taobao, which is Taobao and Tmall, you know, which is 35 times larger. He's going for AliCloud, which is where all the growth is. So why is he doing that? Because he expects that one division to be worth more than the entire company is today. So basically, if you assume it's worth $30 billion today, and in 3-4 years, it'll be worth 200 plus, because they'll go from doing 12 to 30. Operating margins will go from basically 0 to 30%. They'll do $10 billion of operating income. You apply a 20 times multiple when things are humming and you have that growth story on a standalone entity that's not dragged down by the non-profitable businesses. That's where all the money is going to be made. So here, we'll go through some of this. So the idea behind doing a full spinoff is certainly partly due to the consideration we talked about, there being very different business characteristics around the cloud business versus Alibaba's other consumer-facing business. But another part of that consideration is to take this as an opportunity to make adjustments to the shareholder structure and to bring on board strategic investors who can help grow the business in the market. That was also important consideration. Of course, we've given and will give full consideration how to guarantee and maximize the interest of existing shareholders in terms of how to proceed with that spinoff, including giving consideration to tax issues. Clearest way to answer your question when it comes down to our three core strategies, namely consumption, cloud, and globalization. Is that our digital commerce? I think that's clear. Okay. So some companies we could retain a majority of controlling interest, and others we can reduce our shareholding. So you'll basically own the others through your ownership of Alibaba. AliCloud will be spun off into a separate ticker, whether that's Hong Kong. Ideally, I think what they would want to do to get the liquidity and the growth story is do a dual primary where you could have Hong Kong and the U.S. To get, you know, maximum exposure. And I think they'll try to do that. Ability to grow and succeed, but business can do that on a standalone basis and current. Nothing. Okay. And we would love nothing more than to see one of these little Alibabas spinning off from Alibaba and becoming another big Alibaba, as big as the group company is right now. So he's saying that twice. He's not just saying that once. He's saying it twice. And this is a public call. This is, you know, you can't just throw random stuff and random opinions out. There has to be some basis in these type of projections. So I think what you have to look at in respect to each business is whether it has a very clearly defined target market, clearly defined customers, robust business model, core competence. And in the case of the business that has those four things, and cloud certainly does, I think it can succeed independently in the market. So going forward, quote, we would be happy to see, and indeed would expect to see, Alibaba Cloud as an independent company growing to be as big as, and perhaps even bigger than, the Alibaba Group is today. That will be going from being a very diversified group of having individual companies that are each more focused on their own business and strong focus on their own strategy and developing their own core competencies. So he's talking about the other five parts as well. Ultimately, we'll maximize shareholder value. Another key point we made was that AliCloud today is where Amazon Web Services was in 2016. Now, skeptics that don't do their work scoff at this analysis, but we follow the money. Daniel Zhang is currently the CEO of Alibaba Group. When the business is spun out to shareholders to operate on a standalone basis, Zhang is going to run AliCloud. Why? Here's exactly what he said on Thursday's call, which confirmed our analysis. There will be many opportunities to develop. Okay, of course, with the development of AI models, including foundational models, but also industry models, there'll be many opportunities to develop and launch new products for different use cases and different industries. So the development of AI really represents two opportunities. One, that growing demand for computing power, and secondly, the opportunity to develop these products. Finally, as to profitability, again, I think we're still in the early days of development of the cloud, especially as it is a proportion of overall IT expenditure here. So what I've been saying, that China's 5 years behind the U.S. in terms of digitization, he's reiterating here. Now, in terms of where we are today, certainly there does remain a considerable gap in our level of profitability as compared against other leading cloud ventures internationally. What is he referring to? What's the leading cloud venture internationally? It's Amazon Web Services, AWS. Quote, but I see that gap really as our opportunity as we continue to grow and scale and achieve more economies of scale. And in particular, as we develop our core technologies, we see a definite opportunity and are confident in our ability to increase profitability. Now, a key point he noted was the profitability gap between leading cloud ventures internationally, i.e. AWS and AliCloud. I see that gap as our opportunity, blah, blah, blah. Look familiar. AliCloud is where AWS, Amazon Web Services, was in 2016 in the US. So they were doing $12 billion and very low operating income. And then by the time they got up to $30 billion, they were at 29% operating margins. And I think we're going to see a similar type of situation with AliCloud. I think we're still in the early days of development of cloud, especially as it is a proportion of overall IT expenditure here in China. McKinsey agrees with him, as McKinsey projected in their 15-page report. You can we put it out a million times on the website. They expect the cloud to go from $32 billion to $90 billion by 2025. Alibaba's got 36% share. Do the math. That's $30 billion top line. You get the operating margins to AWS at the economies of scale. You're talking $10 billion operating income. 20 times multiple, $200 billion, and by the way, you get the other five parts for free. But, quote, isn't AliCloud cutting prices? I read a headline that said that. The answer is yes, but not for the reasons you think. The reason they're cutting prices in the short term is to control the market in the long term. Once you transfer all your data to their services, to their servers, the switching costs are higher. Then they sell you the higher margin AI and software services that go on top and straight to their bottom line. This is the razor blade model. Give away the razor so you can make a fortune refilling the razor blades for years to come. Gain market share and the profits will follow. Jeff Bezos became the richest man in the world doing this. As Zhang stated above, the key is to get everyone, including students, into their cloud. Then once you have them in, first, sell them more computing power, which will be unlimited demand with AI, quote unquote, unlimited demand. And second, sell them new products, infrastructure as a service, IaaS, PaaS, and AI applications. The AI applications will result in an exponential increase in demand for computing power. This is key. Quote, the AI applications will result in an exponential in demand for computing power. So get them on your server, sell them the AI stuff, and then by the way, AI stuff is high margin. They're super happy. Oh, you don't have enough computing power? We can help you with that. And boom, you charge them on the back end. This is the flywheel that's a huge opportunity for AliCloud moving forward. So more color on AI. We plan to release some of the other large models in the Tongyi series in the near future as a cloud computing product company. By the way, everyone's talking about Bard and ChatGPT. I think when you're talking, you know, 1.4 billion people and the biggest player in AI, I think the biggest AI play is not NVIDIA. I think it's Alibaba, but that's just me. Maybe I'm a little biased. Anyway, AliCloud is committed to investing in core technology development and cloud computing, big data, and AI to make computing more inclusive and AI more accessible. Recently, we've introduced this. By the way, they've got a 200,000 person waiting list wanting to try their AI. New products and pricing policies. We believe these measures can further expand the customer base and cloud consumption of our public cloud services and drive the usage of high-performance computing power required for AI model training and related services. This will provide a healthier and more sustainable growth driver for AliCloud's long-term development. Just starting, guys and girls. Before ending our sharing today, I'd like to say a few more words. Looking back at the recent events from the past few months, Alibaba, like the world we are in, is, quote, at the beginning of a new era of transformation. The world is starting at a new starting point in the world of AI, in the age of AI. The break, and I touched on this with fill you in on CGT in America last night when you watched that. The breaking through of in artificial intelligence will reshape every aspect of our society, how we work, how we live, creating opportunities for disruptive innovations while bringing new problems for mankind to solve together. Blah, blah, blah. Through these efforts, we hope to bring greater long-term returns to our employees, shareholders. Thank you. Okay. Now, more on the cloud. Firstly, the emergence and the broader application of artificial intelligence, large models, large language models, and various vertical models have raised the new requirements for computing power. This is a huge first mover advantage for AliCloud, as we have established sizable path in the past to provide a stable, secure, high performance, and cost efficient computing services. We hope that Alley Cloud Services can not only support our self-developed foundation model, but also support the training and services of other large models and vertical models in the market. Today, we are the leading provider of large-scale, high-performance computing services based on public cloud. Leveraging this technology's advantage, we are working with enterprise consumers and entrepreneurs to support their demand for model and training services. The second opportunity lies in building model as a service or MaaS on top of our foundation. We hope to offer our proprietary foundation model to the general public while supporting our customers, partners, and developers to produce vertical models and services in need based on our foundation model. In April, we released a large language pre-trained model, Tongyi Qingwen. Okay. Currently, more than 200,000 customers have applied for trial access, and we've started to work with several industry partners to develop vertical models based on Tongyi Qingwen. We also plan to launch cloud products and enterprise solutions based on Tongyi model. At the same time, the emergence of large models also brings new opportunities to integrate AI with the various businesses within the Alibaba Group, starting with DingTalk. We believe that all of our customer-facing and consumer-facing business can be reinvented with a large model to offer new AI-based service experiences for users. Qingwen, our large language model, is just one member of our family of our Tongyi series for preaching models. Now, this is, people were concerned about the 2% year-on-year delta. Cloud revenue declined by 2%. But actually, when you look at that, the fact that they lost their largest customer because TikTok was forced to switch to Oracle in the U.S. to stay in the business, those revenue contributions to Alibaba Cloud decreased 41%. So despite losing the 41%, they were still basically flat year on year, which, if you think about it, shows that the rest of the customers are growing and they're adding to their business, and they'll just replace this and continue to grow. In addition, the resurgence of the pandemic in China in January also impacted public cloud consumption and the delayed delivery of certain hybrid cloud projects during the quarter. But if we zoom out from the short-term fluctuations in cloud revenues and look back at Alibaba Cloud development over the past 14 years in the cloud vast future, with the rapid development of AI, we see massive market potential and remain confident about the cloud's future. Alibaba Cloud, we got to where we are because Alibaba Cloud sees two historic opportunities. Number one, rapid development of China's mobile internet, and number two, digital transformation of traditional industries. With its leading industry technology and products, Alibaba Cloud establishes market leadership in China and globally by supporting the growth of many digital native enterprises and the digitization of many industry customers. Today, the age of AI brings two new historic opportunities to Alibaba Cloud. So it's basically day one, except that they're the largest player with the biggest moat. Other key points from the earnings call, some stuff on Taobao. Basically, they saw March and April huge pull forward, growth in users and growth in orders. And that was the new division head talking about that. So that's a big deal. That business alone generated the vast majority of, that's one of the six parts, generated $25 billion of free cash flow last year. And that's at COVID level growth rates. So now as we come out in that pent up demand, I think we're going to see growth, but no one's got that in their models. And then other ways to unlock value. Leadership, we're committed to improve shareholder return and execute a robust capital allocation framework as a holding company that is focused on three priorities. First, strength of our balance sheet and of our cash position is a competitive advantage in an uncertain environment. We remain a prudent approach to our capital structure. We will be focused on improving return on invested capital. These are the magic words to my ears that we heard from management's incentives are tied to it with Cooper Standard. Now we have Alibaba management talking about the importance of return on invested capital in managing the assets of the company. Second, we'll design, review, and implement EPS accretive activities, including constant share buybacks to reduce our outstanding share count while maintaining discipline. This has been my argument, discipline in managing our ESOP programs, which is shareholder comp to management. They've been giving too much of it, so now they're going to get some discipline and religion on that, thank God. And third, we will explore all options to enhance shareholders' return by achieving more transparency in the value of our asset and returning capital to shareholders, including subsidiary fundraising, IPOs, and spinoffs. From April 1st to May 17th, we repurchased another $2.3 billion in ADS. Currently, we still have an unutilized amount of $17.1 billion under the share repurchase program that we'll continue to execute. Under reorganization, each business group will have their own employee stock ownership program that aligns the interests of their management and employees to their business performance and equity value creation. This, in turn, means less issuance at the holdco level in the future. This is key because they're going to be buying stock but not diluting it with giving it back to employees. After which, each business should have their standalone financing capability, further optimize our capital structure to strengthen our cash position, can be used for shareholder return, committed to execute EPS accretive activities that improve shareholder return. So basically what they're saying is the money losing businesses, you're going to be on your own. Go raise capital in the public markets. We're going to keep that capital to return to shareholders. During the fiscal year, we bought in $129 million of our ADSs, or $10.9 billion, which was 44% of their free cash flow, which is pretty good. I mean, everyone says, well, they're very conservative. I mean, 44%, could they go up to 50 or 60? Maybe. But if you consider they're going to be doing $30 billion of free cash flow, that's 12 to 14 billion a year in buybacks. That's pretty darn good. We see market opportunities in China's consumption recovery post the pandemic and rapid development of artificial intelligence. In cloud computing, emergence of AI has created a higher demand for our computing power. The foundation models have expanded AI's application in all aspects of life. Alibaba Cloud will be focused on seizing these historical opportunities to maximize market potential. We plan to fully spin off the cloud intelligence unit within the next 12 months. So all of this happy talk is fine and dandy, but what are the next catalysts to bring it out of the funk? It meaning Alibaba, emerging markets, China. It's not just Alibaba, by the way. It's the emerging markets index, the KWEB index, JD, Tencent. They're all trading the exact same chart pattern. So it's not like, oh, it's just the one we picked. It's every single stock has been doing nothing for the last 12 months. You can see it's made zero progress. It's just been going sideways until it doesn't. And then everyone will say, wow, what happened? So the two catalysts is the debt deal completed. This will unwind the recent safe haven bid to the US dollar. And number two, the Fed pause in June confirmation will cement the downtrend in the US dollar that began in October. So we've gone through this many times. As the dollar goes up, BABA crashed. Once the dollar peaked, Alibaba bottomed at about $60. And then the dollar rolled over. Alibaba rallied 100%. Then the dollar got bid. Alibaba crashed. And now the dollar's strengthening and we got another weakness. So the dollar will resume its weakness after the Fed pauses and the debt deal is completed. You get that safe haven bid out of the market. Cooper Standard, a key customer for the Cooper Standard in the U.S. is Ford, maybe their most important customer. In a pivot from its COVID-era framework of scarce production and higher prices, Ford stated this week it intends to reclaim 2018 to 2019 unit number, which implies another a million additional units above current estimates. This will be a monster boon for Cooper Standard, well ahead of schedule, if Ford can hit the targets it laid out last week. So we're pretty excited to see that. Here's a reminder of what we think those car volumes will mean to shareholders, and you can click there. Basically, we think the company can get back to $7 a share in earnings power over the next few years, and if you get a trough multiple of 10 times, you got a $70 stock. If you get a peak multiple of 20 times, you got double that. You cut them both in half, you still have a multi-bagger, so we're pretty enthusiastic. It's interesting. We'll wind up probably making 3 or 4 times more money in absolute dollars on Cooper Standard than we'll make on Alibaba, but we're known for Alibaba. So it'll be more exciting when Alibaba hits $200-$300 than it will be when Cooper Standard hits $60, $70, $80, because no one will even care. It'll be like, it's just the way life works. But that's the way it goes. All right. Now, on to the shorter term, retail investors are still sentiment, still bearish, throwing in the towel at the wrong time. Fear and greed is starting to build a little bit, and institutional active investment managers are underweight equity still. So, moving along, earnings, financials top 30 weights were revised down 2.6% and 3.19% for this year and next year over the last 60 days. So that's reflected in the stock price. The market's come down huge in addition to all the other externalities. Healthcare, which is a defensive sector. This is the pharmas. This is the insurers. This is the medical device, the boring stuff that you buy when you think there's a recession. They've come down 0.4% for 2023 and 1.25% for 2024. So that's that. And then economic data. I would say the big things today was the continuing claims came in better than expected. Initial jobless claims came in lower than expected. So it's going to be a push-pull for the Fed, but I think their banking worries about the portfolios are going to supersede their inflation worries. They'll call it a skip in June, and it will probably wind up being a pause because we're going to get the tsunami of the owner's equivalent rent take down the CPI headline and core this month and next month, and then after their quote-unquote skip, they'll actually be able to just pause and keep it at that level for some time, and that's that. Or if they hike, then probably the market will be right, which means they'll be cutting by the end of the year because they've overdone it, but I think they'll skip and then they'll wind up pausing. This is interesting. The word recession is coming down, was 238 times in the Q2 calls of last year when we actually were in a recession, just like it was 210 times when we were in a recession in 2020. Now it's down to 107 because we had the technical recession last year and companies aren't seeing that as much, which is really good. And earnings estimates continue to stay elevated at 246. So we'll let that load while we get on to the ask me anything questions. So, all right, let's go. First one is from my friend Bill. He said Zim Shipping Company, and I had an analyst present this company to me literally when it was in the 40s, after it was up like 10x in a year. And those of you listening know I took a hard pass. That was an easy decision. So now it's off 75% from those levels. And it's kind of interesting. You know, the thing I said to my friend was that I don't know anyone who's gotten rich buying publicly traded shipping companies. Usually they're designed to benefit the sponsors, not the investors. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. But when you look at Zim, now that it's down 75% from where that analyst suggested we should buy it, it's kind of worth looking at. If you look at, you know, revenues, so when it went up 10x, it jumped from $4 billion to $10 billion in a year. Peaked last year, now it's trending back down. So it's on a downtrend, which is a little worrisome, but, you know, and earnings have basically halved. So the key that you have to get, you know, shipping, yeah, EPS is halved. But it's still trading at a hugely low multiple. The balance sheet seems okay. The cash flow is still monstrous, but it's coming down. The problem is it's on a downtrend. So what you have to get comfortable with, but the free cash flow yield is still huge, is why is it on a downtrend and when does that trend happen? Because if the trend persists, even though it's the modest downtrend, the market's going to extrapolate that trend in perpetuity, and the stock's going to continue to go down. But if you can listen to 8 calls and understand why it's a temporary impairment versus a permanent impairment. This type of business at this type of prices is probably worth a punt. For me, it's not interesting because it's too cyclical, it's too volatile, and too unpredictable, and I've just never seen this shipping. It's kind of like the gold miners. Gold could go to 50,000 and the gold miners will figure out a way to lose money. It's the same type of ship as the shippers. The volumes can go through the roof and somehow equity shareholders wind up with nothing other than a dividend for 5 minutes before it gets cut. So I'm skeptical. I don't know this group. They're from Israel. Apparently they've been around for a long time. So I would just, you want to listen to the last 8 calls, read the last 2 annual reports, try to understand why this trend, this reversal is temporary versus permanent, or you may find out that it's permanent. But you know, there's a decent enough margin of safety based on how much cash they're generating versus what you're paying, what you pay and what you get. And at these levels, it warrants further investigation. So I think it's interesting, and it may work, not for us, but definitely worth a look and a good find. Paul Gertz. Tom, thanks. Oh, wait, one more. Another friend asked me about... he's a friend in the restaurant business. I'll leave it at that. You know who you are. UAN. So UAN is a fertilizer type company, I think. And so it's up 30 times in 2 years. And now it's pulled back a little bit. The thing about it is it's got like a 40% dividend yield, which scares the hell out of me. So CVR Partners, it's a limited partnership. And we'll look in a second, but they do like fertilizer. You can see their free cash flow had bottom, now it started to pick back up. And then the question is this trend, you know, this is another very cyclical business that's, for me, a trade. And if I'm looking at it as a trade, I think after it's done a 30 bagger, the trade is kind of over. That doesn't mean it won't persist. I just think the risk reward is not as attractive. But let's take a look at what's happening with the business. So the margins are expanding. Their cash flow peaked last year and is now starting to roll over a little bit. And they just started paying out all this cash. So this is a cash machine. Let's see what their balance sheet looks like. For now, it is, because the fertilizer business is very cyclical as well. Let's see here. Long-term debt. What's going on with their top line? Top line is growing. So look, a stock that's up 30 times in 2 years is pricing in a lot of good news. So the only way you could touch this type of thing is to have confidence that this is going to continue to grow. And what changed from it being a basically a garbage company from 2012 to 2020, which constantly eroded shareholder value year after year after year, to all of a sudden, overnight being a monster? And that might be a moment in time where there are scarce resources of what they were selling, and as the supply chains come back, there's going to be a glut in the market and this game is over, which could be why they're paying out all the cash while they have it. So for me, I personally just wouldn't look at it because it's already up 30x. That doesn't mean it can't go up another 30x, but you'd have to listen to the last few conference calls. Go to the website for the CBR Partners. Just Google CBR Partners Investor Relations. Listen to the last four conference calls and just try to understand what's changed about their business that's made it so great and why they think that level of growth is going to persist. Because if it's not, it's going to roll right back over and start to perform. So was there a change in management? Was there a change of acquisitions? What changed from being a garbage business that just eroded consistent erosion of value? Was there a management change? What changed and why? And only then would I consider it. But for me, it's probably a pass. But I understand why you're looking at it. That's a huge cash yield. But history shows those usually don't last. Paul Gertz, thanks again for all the information you put out each day and week. I had a question regarding the debt ceiling. Why does the dollar get bid if there are fears that, number one, the debt ceiling would not be raised, and number two, the U.S. would default on its obligations? Because we're still the reserve currency of the world, and that's where people go as a safe haven. So they'll buy defaulted bonds because they're safer than anything else, because we have taxing and printing authority that other jurisdictions don't have the same benefits that we have while still being the reserve currency, which is going to persist for a long time for reasons that we covered when we talked to CNBC Indonesia the last three times. You can go look up those videos. Next, Zivko Kanizirski. Would you mind taking a look at Charter? The stock has declined from 800 to 350. We have good investors owning the stock. Also, management have been buying, and they are invested in the company big time. Company has been a great compounder, mainly due to buybacks and stable cash flows. Been some problems with video and mobile offering declining due to streaming, but people still need cables to get internet connections slowly. But they keep growing. Major reinvestment cycle in rural areas and reduction of buyback is underway the next 1 to 2 years, which they've already seen very positive amounts of growth. Management is saying the IRR will be very big on those investments, but will take a little longer than usual. They have to build the infrastructure first. Thanks. I think there's something to that. I think there's a lot in the stimulus package, too, that gives subsidies to the rural people. Generally, I think we talked about this a few weeks ago, and I gave a kind of, yeah, probably fine. I think you're going to be okay with Charter at these levels. I think we looked at Charter and Comcast, and we're both kind of okay with them. Not, you know, excited, but not terribly worried either. So you saw cash flow took a dive there, and that's when stock rolled over. Let's see. I just think there are probably better things to do, but I think this is okay. Let's take a look. Yep, top line grown. Bottom line, weakened in the last 12 months. So why is that trend reversing? It had been growing. Now it's reverting back. So just like markets tend to extrapolate growth in perpetuity, they tend to extrapolate declines in perpetuity. And that's why you get these monster drops, even if it's a temporary impairment. And that's the job, is to distinguish, is this a temporary impairment or is this a permanent impairment? Cash from operations is, again, declining from its peak 2 years ago. So that's a concern. Free cash flow is halved in 2 years. Oh, and by the way, so is the stock. No coincidence there. So you have to, you know, dig into that and understand that, is that manana story accurate or inaccurate? I think there's enough margin of safety here. You're probably okay. But this is not much of a compounder. This is a low single digit compounder. It's probably okay, but do your work, listen to calls, read the annual reports, understand why they're going to recover, why revenues are going to start growing again, why cash flow is going to start growing again. And if you can't get comfort that it's a temporary impairment versus a permanent impairment, then just take a pass and put it in your hard pile. But I think you'll probably be okay with this one. Dennis Wong, Thanks for all you do. Can you take a look at KWEB 5-year chart? Looks like a repeat of inverse head and shoulder pattern from 2019. KWEB went straight up for the next 11 months. Thanks again. Go Alibaba. KWEB is probably this exact same chart as Alibaba. Yeah, this is not really an inverse head and shoulders because the head is not lower than the shoulders. I mean, this is all gobbledygook anyway, but, you know, it would imply that it goes all the way back down to 20 before it goes parabolic. But I generally agree. I mean, you have similar bottoms. For me, I just want to own a business that I understand. I like Alibaba. I think I'll get much more juice than investing in KWEB. But if you don't have that confidence about Alibaba or you want some exposure to Tencent and JD and all those in one basket, then KWEB is for you. And if Baba does fine, KWEB will do fine and vice versa. So, but don't buy it on chart patterns, that I can assure you. Drew Byrne, grateful for all your thoughts on Paramount Global as a low percentage portfolio investment. I have a recent starter position, pretty much at 52-week long-term lows. Revenue fell year over year. Free cash flow fell in the past few years. Dividend cut. More competition may limit growth. Increased costs. Streaming platform continues to grow. Recent earnings call. Describe the recent harsher macro environment. Should stabilize and cost reduction has been positive. Cash flow. Integration with Showtime may be reflected in price that may allow for a reasonable multi-bagger with time. That's from Drew. Berkshire has this stock from much higher levels. I think Sherry Redstone recently bought some stock. You know, all of these are trading down. AMC Networks, AMCX, Paramount. There's probably a pony in the pile somewhere. I mean, this is more of a trade. This is more binary. You're kind of just guessing if it's overdone and anything good can happen because the stock is pricing in that only bad things are going to happen. Oh, wrong stock. I think when you get to these levels, you just have to do a bankruptcy analysis. If you're confident it can't go bankrupt, then it's probably worth a punt. Otherwise, just put it in the too hard pile. 26 billion, 25, 28, 30. So revenues are growing. Earnings are collapsing. Or EBITDA, let's see. Net income, yeah, negative. They're losing money in an environment that is very tough to raise money. Not good. Yeah, cash from operations negative. Cash from investing. So they still have big CapEx number. Some cash from financing. Net change in cash. They lost $3.1 billion. Negative $1 billion of free cash flow. So yeah, there's a risk that this thing's going to go BK. I'm sure Sherry won't let that happen, but a lot of long-term debt. I mean, this is a punt. This is a binary outcome. If you're right, you'll make a triple. If you're wrong, you'll get zero. I don't really love those. But there's probably value to the library. This one is a hairy project for a capped amount of money. I mean, your best case, you wind up with a triple, and you might wind up with a zero. That's a little worrisome. You just have to do more work. Read the annual report. Listen to 8 or 10 calls. Try to get some sell side notes, try to get some bearish theses. I don't like the way the numbers are going, but you know, the thing could be bought by Apple tomorrow, you know, you know, so they're, you just have to understand it more and you got to size it. You know, this is more of an options trade. You know, you buy 2 years out, and you expect it to go to zero. And if you're right, you make 5X and, but it's, you know, it's, 20 basis points in your portfolio. So 5X only adds 1 or 2 points, which is not really helpful. Joseph Naus, I'm a BABA holder like you and your fund, but have to recognize that the quote paper of record is continuing to ramp up the anti-China sentiment. I don't think it's much of a conspiracy given its history to say that New York Times is basically in lockstep with the U.S. government on big foreign policy issues. I just showed you a headline from the New York Times that said China tech giants signal first steps in bumpy recovery. I don't think that's much of a conspiracy. I think that's pretty accurate, to be honest with you. It's going to be bumpy and they're going to recover. Today, 5/4/23, two of the top three articles on the front page were China-based, two very critical. I fear that BABA and China in general will not catch a bid while this rhetoric continues. And I see no end in sight for the U.S. politicians ramping up this new Cold War. Do you agree with regard to the sentiment? I think money talks and bullshit walks. And I think that at the end of the day, if the politicians push forward with that, the impact to U.S. multinationals' earnings is going to be so dramatic. It's going to be so dramatic on the politicians' 401ks and their constituents' retirement that eventually, you know, like Churchill said, Americans always do the right thing after they exhaust all other possibilities. So even if your thesis is right and there's some grand conspiracy to have a new Cold War, I just think that there is so much intertwined at this point. You're already pregnant. I mean, you know, there's no undoing it. You know, it is what it is. Yes, you'll have rhetoric, but I think the pivot you saw from Biden this week, and we'll see what happens with the talks this week. But I think we're more towards the tail end, and that's why all the questions I'm getting are scared about all the noisy headlines when, and no one's talking about, well, you know, I found another business that has a 4-year payback period. Should I transfer my Alibaba investment to that one? Because they don't exist. So not of that quality. All right. So can BABA do well without U.S. investors? Yes, it can. But U.S. investors will be the first ones jumping all over the bandwagon once price goes up. So once you get back to denial, you'll start to get some institutions start to step in. And then as you plow up, this is where the retail will start to jump in back to returning confidence around $200. Thanks, Joseph. P.S. Get yourself a copy of James Seekman's Your Short Game Solution. Truly learning what the bounce is and how to use it is the closest thing in golf to legal cheating. I'll take your advice on that. Thanks for that. Sophia Emma Thomas, thanks for all your work and sharing your wisdom and analysis. Thursday evenings, I'm always left looking forward to your video cast. Question, thank you, by the way. It seems like the market is pricing BABA in value trap multiples. Are we experiencing a value trap not due to management but due to the Chinese government? What is the likelihood that buybacks are being limited due to partly influence on the board or on executives? The concern I have is that if BABA historically trades at 35 times on average, now we're at 20 times on a trailing 12-month basis and less than 10 times forward PE. Thoughts? These are the normal cycles. Euphoria to despondency. They want to have cash. We covered that last week. I think they want to have cash so that when they take these five positions to market, they will be coming from a position of strength. They won't need to raise capital in the IPO because they need capital. They'll be able to raise capital because they say, we want to get market multiples versus conglomerate multiples right now the six parts are in, you know, the losers are taking away from the winners' multiples, and when they're all on a standalone basis, they'll get the adequate multiple. So you want to go into that process with tons of cash, number one. Number two, they did buy back 44% of free cash flow. So I think that's pretty aggressive. They need to stop with the ESOP programs and giving away too much stock, which they said they're going to do once it's broken out, and it'll be paid for performance. So I think we're all in that. A value trap is just a value that takes time until it doesn't, and then it takes off. So this is not a secularly declining. We just spent 45 minutes on the future of the cloud, and I think the future is extremely bright. Ite Naman, time is excited as always for the podcast. Wanted to pick your thoughts about UK macro regarding inflation and discretionary spending. Wishing you and the family a great weekend. Yeah, you saw UK inflation finally drop below 10%, so that's positive. That'll continue to come down, just like the US, and you'll see the discretionary spending pick back up. Jake Weinstein, what do you think of New Flyer Industries? All right, we'll cover that one. All right, New Flyer Industries. I've never even heard of it. New Flyer. This is a Canadian stock. Going straight down for 5 years. NFI Group sells buses. Canadian $14. Is that right? No, that doesn't seem like it. It's not even coming up. New Flyer. When you send in a, let's see, Flyer Industries. It must be too small. It's not even coming up, so I can't help you on that. But for me, it's a tiny Canadian company that's been in a straight downtrend for 5-6 years. It would have to be new management, new product, new acquisition. Something has had to change, or they're going to continue to erode value for a long time. But see something. Yeah, it doesn't make sense that it's not coming up. No. All right, I wish I could help you with that, Jake. Sorry. That's not the type of stuff we usually cover anyway. Matt J. from North Carolina. As Alibaba breaks into divisions, has spinoffs and IPO, how does this work for stock owners versus option owners, since I am both? For example, if Alibaba stock owners are given shares in a new IPO, will long-dated options reflect this somehow? Or do option holders not gain any value in the spinoff since they only have a contract to purchase the stock ticker BABA? Sorry if this is a naive question. Appreciate all your expertise and willingness to educate. I'm a long-time listener. Well, two things. Number one, so the only thing that's going to be spun off right now is the cloud, in which the rest are going to do IPOs, but the holdco is going to own them, or at least so you'll extract that value through your ownership of the parent. My guess is that the AliCloud IPO, if the timing is right, will be dual listed in Hong Kong and the U.S., in which case you would get U.S. options. If it's Hong Kong, that could be tricky in terms of you might get Hong Kong options, or better, as you get closer, what you'd want to do is exercise your options for stock, and then you'll get the stock in the spin and, you know, work it that way. So for 90%, five out of the six pieces, it's not going to be an issue. For the one piece, you got to see, as the headlines come out, where are they going to list and how your options will translate. And if they're not going to translate, then just exercise them into stock and take profits, or roll some into the Hong Kong stock, or play it that way. So, but my sense is that's 12 months off. You'll be realizing some value in those options well ahead of them. And then you just have to decide how long you want to hold the SpinCo, and how you want to hold the SpinCo. So there will be ways to extract that value, but we're majority in stock versus options. But with the options, we'll extract it one of the two ways, exercising it or holding it in Hong Kong, or ideally if they have a US ADS simultaneously, that'll be the easiest and cleanest, which my guess is they'll probably want to do for the cloud business to get the maximum multiple. So with that said, we're done for this week. We'll happy Memorial Day. We'll see you next week, same time, same place. In the meantime, make it a great one. Bye for now.